It's called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet, and this is the hour we will get you involved with us. It's interactive, and we'll take your calls next. And welcome back to Coast, back with McKay Jenkins and your phone calls. Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. What happens to companies like Monsanto, McKay, who are involved in a possible merger? What happens to them if we're victorious and we fight GMOs?
Well, I don't think they're going to go down easily. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that these companies put into fighting things like labeling laws, it's staggering. I mean, they put tens of millions of dollars into the California fight about labels. In Maui, this tiny little island in Hawaii where local people were trying to kick these companies off the island, they put, I think it was $8 million into a county ordinance, So think about the last time a giant multinational came into your county and put millions and millions of dollars to prevent you from passing a law that would give you more control over your own land. So they're not going to go down easily. You know, there's an awful lot of money at stake with these companies, and they like the control that they have over our food supply. I go back to what I said earlier before the break, which is that I think the solution to this is to stop giving them your money. Let's start giving money to farmers that we can actually see and come to know and trust that they're going to feed us in a way that'll be much healthier for us. You know, this food system has become so radically centralized, not just geographically, it's centralized in the middle of the country, but it's centralized in this half dozen companies that control everything. And I don't think that's to anybody's benefit. It's certainly got environmental consequences. It's got health consequences. And then if you think about it, I mean, for those of your listeners who are of Irish descent, for example, may know that the Irish potato famine, which, you know, sent hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Ireland because the entire food economy was built on one crop, yep, potatoes, which got knocked out. If you have 200 million acres of GMO corn and soybeans, and some bug finally figures out how to take those plants down, our entire food system would collapse. And that is not a good idea. You don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket. You don't want to have your entire country eating just a couple of different plants. That's absurd. You may know that every banana that everybody has ever eaten in this country is what's known as a Cavendish banana. They all look the same. Mm-hmm. They're all delivered to your supermarket green. You know how it is. They ripen and then people eat them. There's one species of banana that is shipped around the world, and there is a fungus that has now attacked this banana species.
Oh,
and it is now going country by country, knocking out banana plantations, and there will be, in a very few years, most likely, no more bananas left, unless some of these scientists can figure out a way to fight this. But when you have an entire food system built on just one crop, all it takes is for a virus or a bacteria or a fungus. They're always trying to pick the lock of the defense mechanisms of these plants. And if they can do that, and the whole system is built on one plant, then the system collapses. So we don't want that to happen in this country. We should be spreading ourselves out, you know, getting our food grown by more people in our local communities, and that would safeguard us against a lot of future problems.
By the way, what are those spots on the outside of those bananas after a few days? Little brown spots everywhere.
Yeah, that's just the natural process of decay, which is kind of an interesting thing if you think about it. This GMO apple that they just released, you know, they're selling it as an apple that when you cut it, it won't turn brown.
Right.
Now, people know that when you look at an apple and it's brown, that it is not fresh. Now, suddenly, if you have an apple that when you leave it out and it's not fresh, it doesn't turn brown, then you have once again, like, defused a natural instinct for people, which is like, I'm not going to eat that because it's not fresh. Now it will not be fresh, but it'll still look like it is fresh. So in a way, it's kind of counterintuitive. Like, you want to know your instincts, you've evolved to know that if an apple is brown, you don't want to eat it. But now if the apple is not fresh, but it's not brown, now you can't even figure that out. So this is one of these things where technology is kind of, you know, it's removing common sense, which we've evolved over many, many years to develop.
Before we go to calls, McKay, tell us the story about the Hawaiian-born scientist who did something with papaya.
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating story of a man. Now, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, that there are scientists doing really interesting work that is not in the service of companies. It's in the service of farmers and consumers. Now, there are university researchers like this man in Hawaii who they saw a problem, which was a crop that was being taken out by a virus, in this case papaya, and he knew that if the papaya crops went down, the farms and plantations on his island would go down with it. So he got into the laboratory and figured out how to create a resistant papaya crop. And lo and behold, it worked. And now if you go to Hawaii, you can eat lots of wonderful rainbow papaya that are genetically modified, but they're genetically modified to resist a virus, not to be sprayed with chemicals, not to profit big companies, but to help local farmers survive. So that seems to me the model where you can use genetic engineering to safeguard farmers and to protect consumers and not do it in the interest of these multinational corporations.
Okay, to the phones now we go. We go to first-time caller David in Bronson, Florida. David, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
All right. I was calling about the chlorine effect on Roundup in our water system.
That's an interesting question. Roundup in our water systems, McKay, any possibilities there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really can't emphasize this enough. I think this is a really important question. So Roundup is the Monsanto brand name for this chemical known as glyphosate. Glyphosate is the most popular weed killer in the world, and it is sprayed on hundreds of millions of acres of crops. It's also used by a lot of homeowners to kill things like clover. We talked about this when we were talking about the book Contamination. This product will kill weeds. But it's become so broadly used now that it is leaking. I mean, if you think about it, when you spray chemicals on your lawn or on a farm, and then it rains, these chemicals all get into the soil or wash off into creeks and rivers and ultimately into our groundwater and our drinking water. So, you know, it's common sense that if you spray unlimited amounts of these herbicides, they don't disappear once you put them on the ground. They wash off just like everything else. So it ends up in our drinking water. You know, it's really important that people understand that these chemicals have been used for so long that now weeds are starting to get resistant to them. So now they're using these things called stacked herbicides, where they're taking glyphosate and another chemical known as 2,4-D, which Vietnam veterans will recall was 50% of the makeup of Agent Orange. And now they're building these two things together and putting them on crops. So now we're getting that in our drinking water, too. So, you know, when you hear about this idea of trying to reduce chemicals on food, this is why, because we're getting it in our food, we're getting it in our drinking water, and we should be working a little harder to reduce that if we can.
Okay, back we go. Let's pick up Teresa in Grants Pass, Oregon. Hello, Teresa. Thank you for calling.
Hi, George.
Hi.
And McKay. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I hope I'm not off topic if I want to talk a bit about contamination. I have your book on my computer, My Quest to Survive in a Toxic World, and that's kind of my life these days. I've been diagnosed with a severe case of multiple chemical sensitivities.
Oh, geez.
And I've had to eliminate everything from my life. I mean, laundry products, I have to use a certain kind. I can't be around people who use commercial laundry soaps. I get sick. If I go into doctor's offices, the hand sanitizers make me sick. It's like everywhere you go, everything is so polluted and so toxic. And I feel almost paranoid. And when I go to the doctor, it's kind of like the deer in the headlights. They don't know how to deal with it.
Thank you. You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. So that book, Contamination, has an entire chapter on multiple chemical sensitivity, and your story sounds very familiar to me. And I think, along with this this question of GMOs, they're related, and this is why these two books kind of followed one on the other, because we as a culture have become so saturated with chemicals, whether it's, as you mentioned, all the things that you are now sensitive to are just consumer products, but then there's this whole other universe of chemical exposure through our food. So we've given control over so many things to these chemical companies, which have become so big, and they push their products into our lives in ways that are so invisible that we never actually see how we become affected. And then suddenly you get sick, And lo and behold, the medical establishment doesn't know what to do with it because, of course, they never study this stuff in medical school. Medical school, you study the way the body works, but you don't study the impact of petrochemicals in our drinking water bottles or in our cosmetics. You don't study the effect of herbicides and GMOs on our diet. Those things are way too new. The medical establishment has not responded yet to this because, like I said, this stuff is relatively new on the scene. So now people get sick from their diet. They get sick from using these consumer products. They go to a doctor's office, and the doctor says, "You must be crazy. I've never heard of this before." And that is not because you're crazy. It's because they've never studied it. And that's a problem in all graduate schools, whether it's a graduate school of plant engineering or it's a graduate school for medicine. All these things are intimately interrelated. The earlier caller is saying, well, what about glyphosate or Roundup in our drinking water? Well, what about that? You know, if you spray it on food, you think, oh, well, maybe it'll just stay on the food. It doesn't just stay on the food crops. It gets into our water and into our bodies. It all makes sense. Everything is very closely connected to everything else. And this is absolutely evident in the things that you're talking about with multiple chemical sensitivity. You can't get away from it. You can't live in a bubble. That's just, none of us can. We're all living in this world, and it's not easy, that's for sure.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Teresa. Appreciate it. It's not easy to do that at all. Let's go to Mel in Saratoga Springs, New York. Hey, Mel, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Good evening, George.
Hi.
Good evening to your guest. I have a question in regard to wheat bran versus rice bran.
Sure.
Back in 2006, I had in the racing business, I had a horse who had passed away on me at Belmont Park in 2006, and I was feeding him wheat bran because he was just coming off a foot abscess, and he wasn't really training, so I was giving him a bran mash to keep his digestive system pretty much moving. And I'd like to know, with you mentioned the Roundup being sprayed on the wheat, but this is like during the Chinese, they were talking about China was shipping wheat over to the U.S. and the wheat was in dog food, pet food, horse feeds and things like that. And that it was, I guess it was killing a lot of pets in the U.S.
410-377-6590. Please leave us a message and we'll get back to you.
At the tone,
what
please
is
record
that?
Your message.
Are you still with us, McKay? No, he's not. So you're going to have to get him, Donna. Find out where he went. Call him back up. Yeah, he is gone. But let's go back to you, Mel. Maybe I can help you.
Monsanto must have got a hold of him.
They got him.
That wow. But, yeah, George, you've been in the racing business, and you know the more or less the practice of when a horse is in a downtime, you kind of want to not feed him a lot or his regular ration, you kind of back off. And that's what I was doing because, as I mentioned, he was coming off of a foot abscess. He had an abscess in one of his hooves, and I had to back off on his training, and I was adjusting his diet accordingly. But it was with the wheat bran, and he had mentioned that the wheat bran is sprayed with the Roundup to dry it so it can be refined and before it goes to market. And I kind of wonder whether or not, if that could have been a cause and the correlation between rice bran and wheat bran.
All right, rice bran and wheat. And McKay, you're back with us now, huh? They tried to get to you, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They cut my line. I think that it's a very important question. So you know, you're basing your diet, the diet for this animal, on the grain. You think wheat versus rice, which one is going to be have better health consequences? But you probably never thought about what the chemicals were that were sprayed on those crops. And that's the same thing for humans. Like when you started earlier, George, talking about gluten intolerance, or people with celiac disease, all these people with GI issues that seem to be new things. Well, you know, right now we don't have direct linkages between the chemicals and these diseases because the research is just starting to happen. But if you look at the correlation of the rise in these GI problems and the rise in these chemicals in our diets, they go right parallel to each other. So this is where the really interesting research is happening, is maybe these things are not the fault of the grain, maybe they're the fault of the chemicals that are put on the grains. I should also say that going back to what we were talking about earlier, this notion of monoculture, like it's not just that you eat, you know, people have been eating wheat for a long, long time, but we have now made it so that we're only eating one kind of wheat, one kind of corn, one kind of banana, one kind of soybean. The diversity of the crops that we eat and that we feed our animals is so radically smaller than it used to be. Radically smaller. Every single kind of plant that we eat is now radically fewer than there used to be. So we're eating fewer and fewer things that require more and more chemicals, and this is why the whole diet has gotten off the rails. Like, we just don't eat the way we were designed to eat, and that's a problem for people and for animals.
Okay, Mel, thank you. Good luck to you, by the way. Wayne in Chicago. Welcome to the show again, Wayne. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, George. Just give me a few minutes here. I can answer your question, George, that you asked your guest about, do the agribusiness giants, do they eat their own food?
Yeah. What do you think?
Monsanto has a rule in their companies, whereas no employees can eat GMOs in the cafeteria, period.
Why not?
Because they're GMO food. We sell them. We don't eat them. But anyway, this whole thing about GMOs is a uncontrolled, unregulated, mass human experiment, and they don't know where it's going to lead to. Just let me say this right quick. F. William Engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L. He wrote a book called...
Yeah, he's been on the program.
Right. Jeffrey Smith, Genetic Roulette.
Yep, yep.
Seeds of Deception. Okay, I just want to say this. They're the real scientists, not the pseudo-false scientists that your guest was talking about earlier the last hour, but the real scientists are doing research. One of them was at the University of California, Berkeley. His name is Ignacio Capella. Another one, he was over in Scotland doing research at a research institute over in Scotland. Okay, Putzai is his name over in Scotland, P-U-S-Z. T-A-I. He's the first one who started doing GMO research. He fed rats GMO potatoes. Here's what happened, George. Smaller livers, smaller hearts, smaller testicles, smaller brains, damaged immune systems, structural changes in the white blood cells that made them more vulnerable to infection and disease versus non-GMO fed.
And I bet they died off sooner, too, Wayne, didn't they?
Say that again?
I bet they died off sooner, too, didn't they?
Absolutely. Pigs and cows that are fed GMOs die off.
Well, that'll tell you. That'll tell you. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with your final phone calls with McKay Jenkins, author of Food Fight. And welcome back to Coast, McKay Jenkins with us as we talk about his work, Food Fight, and we'll get to your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with McKay Jenkins, of course, as we talk about Food Fight. So where does the future lie with this, McKay? What do you think?
Well, my hope is that, you know, like all good movements, movements start with information. So if people can get more information by doing some reading, doing some thinking about things, then they get energized and angry or activized, and then they can go out and actually start making some changes. This is what happened in Hawaii, where a bunch of, you know, small groups of people did, in fact, pass laws against some of these giant companies. And then, of course, the big federal boot of the regulatory agency came down and squashed these democratic movements. So what we need to do is spread this. We need to spread information, spread knowledge, spread consciousness of the way we eat. Like I said before, support local farms, support local production of food, and maybe, you know, with a groundswell of that sort of thing, we can get back to a little more sensible way of making our food and eating.
What about people trying to grow their own foods? Not everybody can do that. Not everybody has the space. But what about that?
Well, you know, a lot of people say things that, you know, the biggest problem here is ignorance, period. But in this case, ignorance of the way food works. Like, what does it take to grow something? And if more people just simply put a tomato plant in a pot and watch the miracle of this thing growing, they might connect a little bit more to their food, and then they might be a little more reluctant to eating the kind of garbage that is being sold to us. You know, I'm thinking also, this, I wrote about this also in Contamination, this goes back to like people's lawns. Like, if you, instead of planting grass and spraying chemicals on your grass, if you planted, let's just say, for example, a plant like milkweed. Milkweed is considered by farmers to be a weed, and they spray all kinds of chemicals to kill it. Milkweed happens to be about the only food that monarch butterflies will eat. And when you have, like I mentioned, 200 million acres of farms that are spraying things like Roundup on these farms, it kills all the weeds, including milkweed. And now monarch butterfly populations nationwide are at about 4% of what they were. So we're seeing basically the quick extinction of one of the most beautiful butterflies on the continent happening because we spray herbicides on our food crops and we spray herbicides on our lawns. You think about bees, which has become a national problem. My state of Maryland just passed a law that is eliminating these things called neonicotinoid pesticides, which are partially responsible for killing bee colonies all around the country. And we're talking about insects that pollinate something like 30% of every piece of food that we put in our mouth depends on bees. And because of these chemicals, we have basically destroyed bee populations.
Yeah, wiped them out.
Yeah, and I should mention also, you had a caller earlier talking about, you know, like Monsanto not letting people eat GMOs in their own
cafeterias.
There are companies in Europe that are part of what we're talking about. Syngenta is one, BASF. These are big chemical companies that make chemicals that are illegal in their own countries and illegal even in their own continent, but they are allowed to sell them here. The neonicotinoid pesticides are insecticides are one of them. Atrazine is another one of your callers talked about, a Berkeley researcher. There's one there named Tyrone Hayes who's been talking about atrazine's effect on nature and people, and he talks about these herbicides being illegal in the countries that make them, but the United States buys them and sprays them in huge volumes. That's a real issue, this globalization of these chemicals, and America seems to be the most willing to take the most of these most toxic herbicides and insecticides and use them all over the place. Other countries won't even allow them. It just doesn't make any sense.
Okay, back to the calls we go. Jefferson City, Missouri. Hi, Paul. Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George. You have the greatest show, and you've got to be the nicest guy on the radio. Boy, thanks for that.
Thank you.
I'm a heavily targeted individual who called from Jeff City, who called recently about snake venom. Mm-hmm. And being targeted, I'm familiar with chemtrails, and they supposedly contain a lot of aluminum, and I suspect they're involved in mind control.
Barium and things like that.
Yeah, and I had heard Monsanto has developed aluminum-resistant corn. I wondered if you'd heard anything about that.
Aluminum-resistant corn, McKay.
I confess I don't. What do you know? What it's being designed for? What's the goal of it?
Well, that's what I was. People have talked about. It might be to combat all the chemtrailing that has so much aluminum in it that's polluting the soil, perhaps to the point where they have to have something.
Interesting take there.
But and also, I wondered if GMOs might be used in the process of mind control or anything.
You know, I don't know about that. I do know that when we were talking earlier about how GMOs is mainly used on soybeans and corn, and so far has not been, they have not released GMO wheat. And wheat is also, like those other grains, is planted on, you know, close to 100 million acres of American land. It's not like they haven't invented it. They have. Like, there's GMO wheat that is ready to go. And the minute that they can turn popular opinion back in favor of GMOs, this wheat will, I'm guessing, will be released in enormous quantities. So, George, when you asked about what the future holds, this is kind of one of these linchpin things. Like, if Americans will eat the GMO apple, is that one more baby step towards GMO wheat? Now, GMO apples is nothing. GMO wheat will be a game changer in terms of the amount of land and the amount of food that is, you know, built off these GMO crops. So this is why this public relations component and the awareness of these things is vital, because people need to stay right on top of how these things are developing to see, you know, what the next thing that's going to be encroaching on their diet.
Is the opposition to GMO organized or splintered?
Oh, I think it's organized. It's pretty loose, though. And I honestly, you know, it's kind of what you started out the whole hour talking about. There's an awful lot of bad information out there. So there are a lot of people get very worked up about GMOs, and then they start frantically looking on the internet to find out information. And there's a lot of bad information out there. There's bad information put out by industry, but there's also bad information put out by the anti-GMO crowd. This is what my book tries to do, is walk through all this and see what is useful information and what is nonsense. And it's very difficult because, you know, the internet is full of, we all know, it's full of so much nonsense out there that it's difficult to be able to weed through it and figure out what is credible and what isn't. Like I've said all along, it's not that all GMOs are bad. It's that the ones that we are most exposed to are bad. But it's not like the technology itself is bad. The technology in the right hands could conceivably be used to make agriculture more sustainable, more nutritious. And if that was true, then that might be a useful thing. But creating unhealthy food on millions and millions of acres of land, polluting the soil, polluting the atmosphere, that is a demonstrably bad idea. And GMOs are very intimately tied up with all that.
All right, back we go. Let's go to Justin in Toledo, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Hello, Justin.
Yes. Well, I've been listening a while, and I haul fertilizer for a lot of farmers, so I work with a lot of farmers myself, and they've told me stories about not only GMOs in the crops they grow, but the liquid steroids that they pump into our chickens, our cows, and our pigs.
Oh, yeah.
To make them bulk up faster for slaughter. Now, my question is what's the, they say that the steroids won't affect the human body, but as you see, my question is, what I've seen, I think it does. I mean, do you think it would have an alternating effect on the human body if we eat these animals that are pumped up with steroids?
What do you think of that, McKay? I think there's no question.
I don't think there's any doubt at all. I mean, if you think about, I mean, the stuff that I've written about, which is happens at much lower volumes, like, for example, if you drink water out of a plastic water bottle, the plastic in the water bottle has hormone-disrupting chemicals in it. And if you drink water out of that bottle, you can test your body and find the plastic from the bottle in your body just from drinking a single bottle of water. Now, if that's true for a single bottle of water, think about what it's like to go through your day or your year and eat meat that is grown with all of these steroids, all these antibacterial chemicals and the herbicides that are sprayed on the feed that was given to these animals. All these chemicals are cycling through the animals' bodies. They're being slaughtered and processed and going into your body. It's completely common sense that this stuff would get into us as well, which I think goes back to your question about these GI disorders. How can you possibly point to one thing that's causing it when we've got chemical saturation in all of these products all day long? So I think your caller's right on the money for that.
These our listeners are so into things like this, McKay. It's amazing.
Well, I think there's good reason. I mean, I think your show is a very useful platform to discuss information, like what information is out there, who is creating it, and what can we believe? I mean, this whole notion that there's information floating around and a big percentage of it is manipulated and is false and is meant to sort of mislead us. And when it comes to things like food, that really aggravates people because all they want to do is eat a healthy diet and feed their kids a healthy diet, and they can't get any information about it. It's incredibly aggravating when you see these anti-labeling laws or you see these companies that refuse to disclose what they spray and where they spray. I mean, how are we supposed to trust any of that? This is what I think the primary goal of my work is, to simply get information out there that people can then use to make better decisions and get information they can actually trust.
We've got Walt in Allentown, Pennsylvania now on the wild card line. Welcome to the show, Walter.
Hi, George. Once again, I'm honored to be on the air with you.
Thank you, sir.
Well, with all due respect to your guest, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be concerned about, what's in our environment as far as the chemicals and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But, George, man has been genetically modifying his food since the dawn of man. We've always hybridized our fruits and vegetables. We've selectively bred our cattle. George, a nectarine wasn't present in the Garden of Eden. It's a product of crossing a peach with a plum.
Now, that is right, except that was all done naturally. Now the process, of course, is genetically altering, and that could be a problem.
Well, this is what your caller just suggested is very much what you will hear from plant geneticists, the guys that are in the laboratory. They will say that altering a genome for a plant is no different than traditional breeding, traditional hybridization. The question really is how rapidly it's done, for example. You know, evolution takes a very, very long time. Hybridization takes a shorter amount of time, but can still take generations and generations of a plant's life. If you go in there in a laboratory and do it overnight, you're introducing a new thing. There's also a lot of research going on in genetics, which talks about what is known as epigenetics, which is the way that the unpredictability of inserting one gene in one long stretch of a chromosome. Some scientists think that that's a very simple, predictable, understandable process. Other scientists say, we have no idea. There's so much that we don't know about the way the genetics work. How can you possibly be sure that taking something from one species and introducing it into the genes of another species, how can you possibly know what all the potential consequences are? For example, there are people out there doing research now into trying to make photosynthesis more efficient. Now, think about this as a Greek tragedy in the making, where you have a scientist getting in there and monkeying around with something as fundamental to nature as photosynthesis. So you say, well, we can make a plant more efficient as it takes the energy from the sun and turns it into sugars and turns it into a bigger, fatter plant much quicker. Well, what if you could do that? Then suddenly you have this kind of Superman plant that is now bulking up faster, but it's also going to be sucking up nutrients out of the soil and sucking up water faster, which is going to cascade. I mean, we're not just talking about one plant. We could talk about potentially tens of millions of acres of plants. So we're talking about like monkeying around with systems that we only really barely understand. Even scientists only barely understand, let alone the rest of us. So this whole idea of monkeying with natural systems is one of the reasons that people are very suspicious of this whole GMO project. It seems cool at one level, and it seems kind of terrifying at another level, because it's going into natural systems and putting man's brain into it. And man's brain, as you well know, is not always such a reliable thing.
No, sometimes it's mush.
Yeah.
What's your next work? What are you up to?
Gosh, I don't know. This thing has opened up so many cans of worms for me. I continue to be fascinated by this notion of things that are part of our lives that are everywhere and yet invisible at the same time. This seems to be a really interesting place of tension, to see the products that we have in our stores, the food that we have in our supermarket that we come into contact with every day and yet know almost nothing about it. So I think I'm gonna stay with this for a while and see where it leads me.
Let's go to Chris and Balt in Minnesota, a first-time caller for us. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Hey, George. Thank you for letting me on the air, and shout-out to everyone on WNAX listening tonight.
Super.
All right. You still there?
Yep.
All right. Couple things. My background is I've been raised on a family farm, and I've been around farming all my life, and I also went to school for agronomy, and I currently have a job where I help farmers manage their fields, so they, for what they're putting on the fields, what the chemicals you guys are talking about. And I think there's some misconception out there of what actually is going on. First off, I'd like to say, would you believe me if I told you that because of GMOs, I use less chemicals?
Oh, I would believe that.
So actually, since the advent of GMOs, we have been able to use less chemicals in the last 20 years than we did before that.
Well, that was, of course, one of the reasons they came up with GMOs, McKay, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, I'd be curious to know what exactly he's talking about, because it's true that they often use fewer insecticides if you're using something like BT corn. But the fact is that the amount of herbicides has actually way outstripped that. So collectively, farmers are using fewer insecticides but way more herbicides. And the net, I think, is like a 7% growth in chemicals. So you're right, farmer by farmer. If you're a corn farmer, you might be using less. But if you're a soybean farmer, you might be using more. So it really depends on what crops we're talking about.
Right, and actually, it does. It depends on farmer by farmer, field by field, is what we kind of do.
Yeah.
Just for example, you talked about glyphosate earlier. Do you have any idea what the rate farmers put on per acre of glyphosate is?
I don't. I just know that the net use of it is growing globally, and that the science about the dangers of it is also becoming more nervous now than it used to be.
And, you know, I definitely respect those nerves, but I'll just tell you, for example, on my own farm, what we do when we apply glyphosate, or Roundup, as many people know it, we apply an average rate of approximately 32 ounces per acre, and that is enough to get rid of the weeds that are in the field that are hurting the crop when they grow. And just for perspective, an acre, for people that don't know, is about 43,560 square feet. And
well, I'm curious, have you noticed any resistance? Have the weeds built up any resistance to the glyphosate?
That has become a large concern of ours, and I work with farmers very closely to manage that, to make sure we don't make that problem any worse.
All right, thank you. McKay, the clock's going to get us. I want to thank you. Would you give us your website?
Sure. It's just my name, mckayjenkins.com, and there's lots of information about the book Food Fight, and also contamination for those who are interested in the consumer products. So lots of information there, and I'm really grateful to be on your show. It's always a pleasure to talk.
We'd like to use you as a resource every once in a while, too, on breaking news stories when it comes
anytime.
To this. Okay?
Anytime.
Great.
Thanks so much, George.
Thanks. McKay Jenkins, his book, Food Fight. Up next, we're going to talk about the very mysterious Coral Castle in Florida, made by a very mysterious man.